Good evening and welcome. We'll begin with a prayer, if you wouldn't mind standing for a moment. Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one. We have the great pleasure of having Dr. Aristotle Papanikolaou here with us this evening. He's from the United States, and he is currently the Professor of Theology and the Archbishop Demetrius Chair in Orthodox Theology and Culture, and he's the co-director of the Orthodox Studies Center at Fordham University. And we welcome you this evening, Dr. Aristotle, and look forward to your talk, which is entitled War and Violence: The Politics of Theosis and the Refugee Crisis, which we in Australia know a lot about too. Welcome.
Thank you. You can tell I'm smiling because I'm so very happy to be in your country. It takes a long time to get here, but it's very, very well worth it. And so it's my first time here. I'm very, very excited, and I'm very excited to be with you. I grew up in the States. I grew up in Chicago. My father was a priest, so I kind of live and breathe the church all my life. And one of the things that over the years I've struggled with and I've tried to do is to make sense of our faith. You know, how does it really make sense? How does it really speak to our lives, to our kind of everyday happenings? And recently, one of the happenings that occurs much too often in our lives and people's lives is violence. And it kind of, one of the questions that emerged for me is, if the church speaks the way it does in terms of our relationship with God and spirituality, and I mean, how does that all make sense when there's so much experience of violence in the world? So that's kind of the general framework of my talk. And I'm going to be kind of going in and out, going a little bit sort of extemporaneous and sometimes reading from my paper, and then we can kind of open it for questions. But that's generally what I want to address. And I want to begin with a story. And so the story is about an American soldier named John, who after returning from combat in Iraq, was readjusting to life with his daughter, his fiancée, and his fiancée's mother. And one day, John and his fiancée were having a disagreement about bus schedules, and a type of disagreement that is normal among couples, but that doesn't really provoke violence. In this case, the former combat veteran, John, became enraged and was overcome by what some psychologists in the U.S. call a berserk state. And John grabbed a knife. He attacked his fiancée and his fiancée's mother, and he cut them with the knife. And later in the hospital, when he awoke, he had no memory of what he had done. And his first question was, "Did I kill my daughter?" And in the end, no one died in the attack, and his daughter is still alive. One of the things the Orthodox talk about, and have talked about it for centuries, is that humans were created for what we call union with God. I know that when we talk about Christianity, we like to talk a lot about heaven after we die. So you might be surprised to know that actually, when we think about the great fathers of our church, they're actually more focused on, they do talk about heaven after we die, but they're actually more focused on what happens to us now. They're more focused on what's possible for us now. And what's possible for us now is to actually experience God more in our lives. And we have a kind of nice word for that, sort of a fancy word, and it's called theosis. Have you heard of that word before? So in Greek, it means divinization, to be divinized, to become like God. St. Athanasius, the great, great 4th century saint, said it the best. He said, God became human so that humans can become God. But that can be easily misunderstood. So the question becomes, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to become like God? And one of the bigger questions, for me anyway, is what possible relevance could that have to the story we just heard? What possible relevance could it have had to that act of violence, and an act of violence that he couldn't even remember committing? And perhaps even the acts of violence that he was committing in war, or perhaps were even committed against him. Now, theosis can be easily misunderstood as, you know, becoming like Zeus and Thor. You know, my children were asked by their non-Greek friends at school once if they believed in the Greek gods. So even among Orthodox Christians, theosis is often limited to the monk who has the great soothsaying powers or healing powers, who is out in the forest feeding the bears or in the desert fighting the demons, almost giving the impression that somehow theosis means having some kind of superhuman powers. But if we recall that the primary naming of God by Christians is love, so we call God a lot of things. We call God good and just and merciful, but the name of all names for God is love. That is the name of all names. Then theosis, to be divinized, must mean to love as God loves. To see all of creation, including the most unlovable, as God sees creation. And this is the great challenge of the greatest commandment, to love God with all of one's mind, heart, and soul, and to love neighbor as oneself. And when understood in these terms, the greatest commandment, theosis, is not superhuman powers over and against everything else. Theosis becomes much more mundane. To be divinized actually is kind of worldly. It's more evident than the boring day-to-day activities of our lives. But see, the greatest commandment is a paradox. We are commanded to love when love itself can't be initiated by the will. If we hate someone, we can't just say, tomorrow, when I wake up, I'm going to love him. It simply doesn't work that way. Because love isn't the same as an act of kindness. You know, you can't will yourself to love someone you hate. But you can only notice that you don't love as perhaps humans are capable of loving. So in many ways, when Jesus gives the commandment, he's pointing to what is possible for us. The real challenge is figuring out how to get there. And the fathers of the church, interpreting this great commandment, they understood that love is a learning. Love is not just a happening like we want to think it is. It's not soulmate kind of thing. Love is a learning. We learn how to love. To some extent, that's why we discipline our own children. We discipline children because, to some extent, without that kind of discipline, without that kind of structure, it's difficult for them to learn how to love, and it's difficult for them to become the kinds of people to be lovable. So love requires structure. And this is not that intuitive. I mean, to some extent we have ideas that love just happens, and somehow if we're not feeling it, then somehow something's wrong with the relationship. But love is difficult. Love is difficult with our parents. Love can be difficult with our brothers and sisters. Love can be difficult with our friends. And then you have Jesus coming along and he raises the bar and he says, love enemy and stranger. That's very, very hard. It's very, very difficult. So even under normal circumstances, to work towards loving as we'd really want to love in the world, to work towards loving even the enemy and the stranger in the world, is very, very difficult. Someone once asked me, what does it mean to love an enemy? And I said, what it means to love your enemy is to look someone that's trying to destroy you right in the eye and not reduce them simply to that. To kind of see something more, the way God sees the more in all of us who really kind of betray God almost daily, almost on a daily basis. God does not reduce us to those particular kinds of acts that we do. And to love stranger has something to do with, rather than feeling obliged to be with the homeless person on the street, one almost feels a certain desire to want to be with the stranger and the homeless on the street. But again, I'm not condemning people who don't feel that. I'm just trying to indicate that love, even within our own family networks, is hard. And it's something that we have to try to figure out maybe how to get better at, something that we can feel more deeply. So what does this have to do with violence? I guess where I'm going with this to some extent is that what I want to try to illustrate for you at this point is two things. One is that love is a learning. And two, that violence makes love difficult. And violence makes love difficult because of the effects it has on the body. And I think that our great spiritual tradition has something to offer in terms of helping to understand all that and even helping people to kind of move forward. Because there's this great saint, Saint Maximus the Confessor. Have you heard of Saint Maximus the Confessor? Saint Maximus the Confessor, a 7th century. Do you know there's only one church in all of Europe dedicated to Saint Maximus the Confessor, and it's in Serbia? There are not many churches dedicated to Saint Maximus the Confessor, but he's one of the greatest, smartest saints in our tradition. And he said that the three greatest obstacles to love are fear, anger, and hatred. Fear, anger, and hatred. And he says, the one who sees a trace of hatred in his own heart through any fault at all toward any person, whoever he may be, makes himself completely foreign to the love for God, because love for God in no way admits of hatred for any human person. And the ascetics understood well that because of our own createdness, humans are plagued by fear. We're afraid of death, but I think this fear masks another fear that I think is more basic, and I think it's a fear that grounds our pride. Like we act proud, but that pride is somehow a mask for a fear, which I think is more basic, and it's a fear for not mattering in the world. It's a fear of not mattering in the world, of not being good enough. And there are conditions in life that make love difficult and that evoke these feelings of fear, anger, and hatred. And one such condition is violence. So again, I want to talk about, I'm going to begin talking a little bit about St. Maximus and this kind of learning how to love. And then I want to talk a little bit about violence and the effects of violence. I want to illustrate how the effects of violence really make love difficult. And then I want to try to kind of marry the two together and see how the wisdom of St. Maximus can be brought to bear on a very, very common occurrence in our day-to-day lives. So in St. Maximus, he affirms all these things I talked about, theosis, communion with God, presencing of God. But then he introduces this new word, he introduces this word as a way of talking about this. And this word is virtue. And he says in his second letter to John, we don't really know who John is, but he has this letter that's preserved to John, and he says, "And the divine and blessed love, which is fashioned from these and through which virtues come to be, will embrace God and manifest the one who loves God to be God himself." To be God himself. Those are really powerful words. So then he talks about how these virtues are kind of the thing which make love possible. So he says, all the virtues assist the mind in the pursuit of the divine love. Now, how exactly does that work? Let's think about that for a minute. How does virtues kind of work and with love and all these other kinds of things? Well, we have to kind of think about virtue a little bit differently. Sometimes we have a way of thinking about, first of all, the word virtue is not really used that much anymore. If you read a novel by Jane Austen, it's practically on every page. But the word virtue isn't really used, which is somewhat indicative in many ways of what's going on in our culture. The kinds of words we use a lot and don't use a lot have a lot to say about what's happening in our culture. So how exactly is virtue related to love and all that? Because we have to kind of deconstruct some of the ways we think about virtue. We think about virtue as this badge of honor. Oh, I have patience, so I get the patience badge. Oh, I have humility, so I get the humility badge, which if you think about it is a bit counterintuitive. You know, if you're humble, you wouldn't want a badge. And we think about virtues as these things we kind of rack up to score points with God so we can get to heaven later. Maximus talks about virtues now in our lives as indicators of God's presence in our lives. You see, he doesn't talk about these things we do like coins that we kind of, or badges that we show to God as we go up to heaven and say, "See all my virtues?" He talks about them as things that we embody, things that we manifest, things that are part of us, of who we are, as indicators that we are closer to God. But even more than that, he talks about them as kind of building blocks of acquiring a deeper love. Now, how does that work? I mean, think about that for a minute. How does that work? Well, I do this exercise with my students. I ask them, I tell them, I say, you know, if you know a couple who's been together for 50 years and they celebrate it, because unfortunately there are couples together 50 years and they don't. But if they've been together 50 years and they celebrate it, what do you think had to transpire over the 50 years for that to happen? And they start listing words. They say, honesty, patience, communication, forgiveness. Because just because they're together for 50 years doesn't mean there wasn't betrayal. Justice. If someone's doing the dishes more than another, sometimes, you know, that can get in the way of love sometimes. It's true, you need justice for love to grow. So they go on and on. Courage, temperance, wisdom. And then I ask them, I say, okay, if you had one word that basically all these other things could be fit under, what would that word be? And see, because the word's not used that much, they can't guess. But they don't realize that they're talking about the virtues. They are talking about the virtues. So you see how that works? All these virtues kind of create a dynamic in the relationship in such a way that the couple over time, through many different kinds of ups and downs perhaps, are able to somehow move towards a deeper and celebrated love. Because the love 50 years, after 50 years, cannot be what it was when it first started. There's no way. So St. Maximus is right. He's right that the end game here is love, a deeper love. And somehow the key to that has something to do with acquiring virtues as little building blocks. There's another great saint called Saint Dorotheus of Gaza, and he talks about how the spiritual life is like building a house, and the cornerstone is humility, and the roof is love. But think about it. He's right also. If you take away the cornerstone, then it all collapses. And it's true. You really can't have love without humility. And I don't think you can have the other virtues without humility. And humility not in the sense of like, I'm such a bad person. Simply humility in the sense that there's something more than me out there in the world. So, quite simply, St. Maximus says, virtues are those kinds of things which build relationships, they allow for friendships, they build intimacy, they bring us, and when we experience more love in our lives and our capacity for love grows, that's when we're experiencing God. We're loving as God loves. Don't wait for a flash of light. Don't wait to fly through the air like Superman. When you have God in your lives, it means that we have the capacity to love more. So that means that if it has something to do with acquiring the virtues, it means that you have to train yourself. Some people are naturally patient, but some people aren't. Some people are naturally compassionate, some people aren't. All of us in some ways have to train ourselves for some virtues. We have to do things. To acquire the virtues is like a training. It's like a training for sports and soccer, or it's like a training in becoming a dancer. It's a training. You have to kind of do stuff in order to acquire the virtues. But in doing that kind of training and acquiring those kinds of virtues, then ultimately we're setting up the building blocks for love. So for example, fasting. You know, what does fasting have to do with learning how to love, right? But if you think about it, the church recognizes that the greatest temptation in our relationship with God is not disbelief, it's forgetfulness. And you cannot build a relationship with someone that you're forgetting day in and day out. You cannot have a friend who you call a friend and you're committed to, but you call them every 5 years or once a year just to say, I'm checking in to affirm your existence. That's not a friendship. There's no intimacy there. You cannot build a relationship with someone by forgetting them. And so the church says, we know that our faithful forget God, so what can we do somehow to get them to remember God? Let's link it to food, because food is something we have to do every day. And then let's link it to the liturgical cycle, where they do these things kind of around the time of some of the important moments in Jesus' life. But let's also add non-fasting periods so they can feel a certain kind of rhythm, which also leads to a kind of remembrance. Let's get them to fast so that when they pass by their favorite souvlaki stand, they don't buy one. And when they don't buy one, the souvlaki stand becomes this space that they wouldn't, although normally they wouldn't think about God, but now all of a sudden they're thinking about God. I do this, you know, where I work every morning, I have this ritual where I go to this grocery store and they have like a breakfast bar and I get like my fruit smoothie because I don't really like eating fruit. So I just try to get it over with in the morning. But then to reward myself, they have this wonderful thick bacon. So I get one piece because I have to watch my cholesterol. So I get one piece. But on days that I fast, I don't do it. And I think about God. And fine, it's a small thing. It's a small thing. But anybody who's played sports knows that the small things are the things you have to kind of latch onto. And in that space, I think about God when I normally wouldn't have. And it still gives me a chance with God. We cannot develop our relationship with God unless we think about God, unless we remember God. And the church has us doing certain kinds of things as ways of recalling God to memory. And in that training is giving us a chance to develop that relationship with God. Just like two people in a relationship for 50 years would do things so that love could grow, we have to do something to allow the God who loves us all the time, you know, to basically allow ourselves to experience the God who loves us all the time. So, virtues have something to do with building our relationship with God, helping us to love God more, just like in any other human relationship, that's what they do. And St. Maximus is right. By building up the virtues, somehow we're kind of moving towards a more loving relationship with God. And we have to kind of do things. That means that vices, dishonesty, betrayal, all those kinds of vices, lying, they destroy our relationships. You can't have a relationship of intimacy, of depth, of authenticity when there are vices. It doesn't work that way. And vices, more often than not, are the things that incite anger, hatred, and fear. The three things that get in the way of love. So, now back to violence. Okay, so just try to keep in mind, in many ways what I was trying to kind of create for you was a vision of the Christian life that's really not about what happens to us after we die, but of the vision of the Christian life that's possible for us now. It's about taking heaven and pulling it now into our lives. But that heaven is becoming like God, and becoming like God means to become more loving people in the world. Violence is one of those things that makes all this very, very difficult. There's a really great psychologist in the United States who was sort of really pioneering with working with veterans after the Vietnam War. And he has this one phrase which is very, very telling. He says that war is the destruction of good character. And violence can do that. Violence can destroy good character, right? Virtue. And if we look at Maximus the Confessor, what we really are talking about is that violence makes love difficult. And let me give you, I'm going to illustrate that for you now a little bit. I'm going to read a little bit more from my paper because I'm going to give you some statistics and some other things. So, post-traumatic stress disorder. These combat veterans that come back experience, many of them experience post-traumatic stress disorder, and the symptoms for them have something to do with things like not sleeping, or some of the dynamics have something to do with not sleeping with spouses for fear that a nightmare may lead them to physically harm their spouse, not being able to sleep in the middle of the night because of hypervigilance, not wanting to be outdoors for fear that a sound such as a bird chirping or water running may trigger combat mode, not being able to enter public spaces such as grocery stores or elevators or coffee shops, having dreams of mutilating their children, alienating friends and families, not being able to hold a job or even get a job for fear of public spaces. Many of them end up homeless, at least on the American streets, with 13% of homeless population in the U.S. being veterans and 20% of the male homeless population being veterans. They are plagued by demonic images and memories of the war. And the high rate of the experience of PTSD symptoms among Vietnam veterans demonstrates that the effects of war endure and linger in the body long after a soldier's tour of duty. We used to think that if someone's in a situation of violence, you take them out and they're okay, and that's wrong. Violence lingers in the body. The body absorbs it, and it sticks around for a long time. So, and this lingering is in the form of, and this is a quote from Jonathan Shea, hostile or mistrustful attitude toward the world, social withdrawal, feelings of emptiness or hopelessness, a chronic feeling of being on the edge as if constantly threatened, and estrangement. In addition to PTSD, a new category is emerging. In order to distinguish PTSD, which is a fear response, from another kind of state of being which has very similar symptoms. And this thing is now being called by psychologists moral injury. Moral injury. And moral injury refers to a state of being in which the combat veteran experiences a deep sense of having violated his own core moral beliefs. And it may occur as a result of killing either combatants or non-combatants, torturing prisoners, abusing dead bodies, or failing to prevent such acts. It may also ensue even if there was no way for the combat veteran to avoid doing such acts. In the experience of moral injury, combat veterans may judge themselves to be worthless, unable to live with an act he or she committed that is a never erasable act. You can't erase when you kill innocent people in war. So, for example, if you're at a checkpoint and you ask somebody to get out, and because of a language barrier, people aren't getting out, and then you shoot up a car of a family that has, you know, nothing to do with the war, you can't erase that. You cannot erase it. It's eternally part of your story. So symptoms are similar to those of PTSD, such as isolation, mistrust of others, depression, addiction, emotional detachment, and negative self-judgments. And there are countless stories that I've heard of combat veterans who admit that they are afraid to speak of all that they did in combat situations for fear that the one to whom they speak will deem him or her unlovable. So in a recent article in the popular magazine in the States called The New Yorker, and the article is called The Return, one of the veterans from the Iraq War is quoted as saying, "I don't want to tell my wife stuff. I don't want her to know that her husband, the person she married, has nightmares about killing people. It just makes me feel like a monster, that she'll hate me What kind of person has dreams like that? So in the case of moral injury, it's really not self-love as much as self-loathing that really is an obstacle to love. Now, the refugee crisis. And here I'm going to talk, I don't really know about what's going on here in Australia, I'm going to talk mainly about Greece. So it's on full display. I mean, it's died down a little bit in Greece now. It's all indications are that Italy now is sort of the center of migration for refugees. But nearly 60 million people worldwide have been displaced and are refugees. 60 million people. And its number is not seen since World War II. And I think it's the most than any other time in history. The 6 to 8 million people were displaced in Syria, and there are 4 million Syrian refugees. Now, the Greeks themselves are well acquainted, as we all know, right? And there's many issues being discussed, like the failure of the European community and the American government in relationship to what the Greeks, and the Greeks themselves have exhibited what I call a politics of theosis, because they've been heroic in responding to the humanity of the refugees and doing all that they can with very limited resources and a financial crisis to simply respond with kindness, patience, care, humility. There's a wonderful documentary maybe some of you have seen it, of a Greek fisherman in Mytilene who went out on his own, and it's really quite gripping, the kind of sacrifices he made. Now, what often doesn't get discussed is the long-term effects of being a refugee or displaced person. They are only now starting to gather data about the refugees that have arrived in Germany, and studies show that half of the refugees have mental health problems because of trauma suffered in war or during their dangerous escapes. More than 70% had witnessed violence, and more than half had become victims of violence, which often included torture. 40% of refugee children had witnessed violence, and 26% had to watch family members being attacked. 40% of adult refugees have nightmares, and 50% have flashbacks, where they relive a traumatic event. The most commonly reported mental illness is post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, often resulting in suicidal tendencies. The long-term effects of displacement and refugee existence are evident in children who are placed in schools in Germany. Children do not have the verbal skills to express their feelings of trauma. I mean, they don't, really. I mean, children experience anxiety, feelings, but they don't yet have the frame of reference somehow to figure out the words and things to kind of talk about it, right? But they're still experiencing it. I remember my son when he was little and he heard the vacuum cleaner, right? And it wasn't PTSD, but this surge of anxiety that he didn't really know what to do with. So he went and hid and did other kinds of things that ultimately he's just trying to get rid of the anxiety. Right, so teachers have to be aware that situations such as dark corridors, people wearing uniforms or heavy boots, loud or harsh talking, bells, fire alarms, evacuation drills, and misinterpreting cultural body language can all trigger anxiety, flashback, and behavioral reactions. All this can affect the child's capacity to form relationships for learning. So violence affects forming relationships, and they can affect forming relationships that lead to deeper friendships and love, and that can affect the relationships that ultimately will help us learn. So this experience in Germany correlates with studies in the U.S. that are now showing that 51% of children who have experienced 4 or more adverse effects are identified as having learning or behavioral problems. These children mostly come from the poor neighborhoods in the U.S. and it is not uncommon for such children to have behavioral problems in school that often manifest itself in rage. Such kids have difficulty sleeping, difficulty tracking in class, they act out, they get kicked out of school. The numbers of people who are experiencing these traumas in the U.S. are really at an epidemic point. Now, what advanced technology is showing, neuroscience especially, they're confirming what St. Maximus knew by intuition, that violence leaves an imprint on the body that endures and that affects our capacities for learning and relationships. So with violence, evil becomes incarnate in the body as vice. In PTSD, it has been shown that the areas of the brain that regulate fear and memory and the relation between the two are affected, and these areas are the amygdala and the hippocampus. If a child is experiencing the constant threat of violence in the home, the stress that such a threat generates can prevent the development of the part of the brain responsible for non-cognitive skills. Another way it was explained is this. If one is in the forest and is confronted by a bear, then the part of the brain responsible for aggression will activate. And that part of the brain responsible for non-cognitive skills will deactivate in order for the person to prepare for an emergency response. But such an emergency response is meant to be infrequent. For some children, living in a family home situation in which the threat of violence is constant, the brain responds as if facing a bear every single day. And then the brain gets formed in that way and ultimately becomes kind of like a habit, but a habit which gets in the way of relationships, which means that it becomes vice-like. If the emergency response of the brain is activated repeatedly, the brain forms pathways that get increasingly ingrained, which is another way to understand the development of vices. In day-to-day situations, this means that it is difficult for such children to learn reading and math in class when the brain is constantly on emergency response mode. Children who cause trouble in school may, in fact, not simply be morally bad children, but might be suffering the existential effects of violence or the constant threat of violence, which are manifested in lack of attention, rage, or even bullying. So look, violence, even neuroscientifically, it's being shown that violence and the effects of violence endure, and they endure in such a way as to create vice-like habits that get in the way of relationships, both for love, friendship, and learning. Now, when I say vice, don't think something wrong that will get you to hell or something like that. Think about the people experiencing hell now. And that somehow, some way, we have to kind of think about what is it that they can do, what are the kinds of training practices that could kind of rewire all that. And rewire all that somehow so that love becomes possible again. A kind of really rich and deep kind of love. Because it's just difficult to love, A, when you're not sleeping very well. I know that sounds crazy, but it's true. Love depends on the body. It's difficult to love when your brain is being formed in such a way because you're facing violence every day in your life. It's difficult to love when you can't when you're kind of so hypervigilant that somehow you can't even that somehow a bird chirping or something will just kind of get you in combat mode, like it happened with John. Those things are how can you think about a deeper enriching love when all those things are happening? So, but there is hope. So neuroscientists have actually discovered that they used to think that the brain's plasticity ended at a certain age, but they've realized now that the plasticity of the brain lasts throughout our lifetime. And that means that the brain can be rewired and new pathways can be formed that one might describe in the language of the virtues. They're discovering, too, that spiritual practices such as certain forms of prayer can rewire the brain. Because as explained by one of the leading specialists in trauma, Basil van der Kolk, who's in Massachusetts, Cambridge, such practices allow, quote, the body to have experiences that deeply and viscerally contradict the helplessness, rage, or collapse that result from trauma. His book, The Body Keeps the Score, is something that, if you're interested in this, is something you should read. And one such practice that they are discovering, for example, that helps trauma victims, not all, it's not a formula, but one that's shown some effect, is yoga. Van der Kolk says, conclusively that 10 weeks of yoga practice markedly reduced the PTSD symptoms of patients who had failed to respond to any medication or to any other treatment. In response to this problem of the effects of violence on learning, there's a program called Head Start Trauma Start in the U.S., which has students engage in practices like breathing exercises to regulate anger and enable learning, and even issuing breathing stars as rewards, realizing that timeouts and disciplinary methods based on fear don't really work. Now, this potential of regulating our breathing for helping with anger, depression, anxiety, perhaps could give us a new perspective on something like the Jesus Prayer. And finally, because trauma victims so often dissociate from the feelings in their bodies, and this disassociation prevents them from proper and healthfully integrating the memories and experiences of trauma, Van der Kolk says that 20 weeks of yoga practice increased activation of the basic self system, the insula and the medial prefrontal cortex. This research needs much more work, but it opens up new perspectives on how actions that involve noticing and befriending the sensations in our bodies can produce profound changes in both mind and brain that can lead to healing from trauma. I mean, let me put this another way. What the neuroscientific research is actually showing is that engaging in certain kinds of practices, breathing exercises, yoga, other research on trauma shows that truth-telling, right, that being in a supportive group where you have to speak the truth about your trauma, all these things are kind of like spiritual practices. They're kind of like fasting, right? I mean, we do a lot of things. We just don't fast. We fast, we pray, we do. All these things are kind of, the Jesus Prayer is a form of breathing prayer. And ultimately what they're showing is that those kinds of things have visible bodily effects. And those visible bodily effects can be linked with what Maximus says about the virtues. The virtues aren't badges. The virtues are those ways in which our body gets rewired so we can open ourselves up to God's love. And by doing that, being able to love people around us. So we can do stuff. If stuff can be done to help people who experience violence experience love again, then that stuff can work for us who, you know, are challenged in different ways, but can still kind of draw on this wisdom as ways of ultimately having the kinds of relationships we want in our life. So I'm going to conclude now. So, again, what I tried to illustrate is that somehow violence has an effect on the kinds of relationships that we form, and by having an effect on the relationship that makes love, friendship, learning difficult. But there's a great deal of wisdom in St. Maximus the Confessor in understanding learning as love as a learning, and that requires a certain amount of training and practices that build virtues, which really is just a rewiring of the body in such a way that makes those kinds of relationships possible again. Right? But violence isn't something that just goes away. It lingers and needs to be transformed. But understanding virtue as an existential category also means that there is a political dimension to theosis, what I call a politics of theosis. By politics, I don't mean strategies that political parties employ to advance their agenda. By politics of theosis, I mean how those who are struggling to learn how to love should shape and relate to the political space. So here we're in the church. We're committed to learning how to love. What does that mean as we go out there? Because the out there is not the church. The out there is where we encounter people who don't share our common belief. It's kind of like the desert where we learn how to love as we encounter the enemy and the stranger. Now, in relation to the refugee crisis, politics of theosis does not respond out of fear by declaring that the influx of refugees will lead to the takeover of Islam, for example. The politics of theosis discerns how the effects of violence on the refugees will affect their God-given capacities to form relationships of love. The politics of theosis would promote a political space defined by radical pluralism, insofar as it knows that faith is realized by persuasion and never by force, blood, ethnicity, or nation. It is an openness to a secular political space understood not as anti-religious, but as radically pluralistic, and that is today the single greatest challenge to the Orthodox countries, including Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, Romania, Georgia, and especially Russia. Now, I want to end with a caution, and I'll be done right here. The paper, my talk is not really saying that all you need is love. This isn't an ode to the Beatles. In fact, what the ascetical tradition knew better than the Beatles is that it's quite not as simple as all you need is love. Love is not willed, but learned and formed in and through particular practices. At its best, the Christian tradition, the Orthodox Christian tradition, is a tradition of thinking on the practices such as prayer, fasting, truth-telling, that realize love in relationship to those near us and to those far from us. So as such, John Lennon does not quite convince me that to imagine no religion ultimately leads us to realizing that all we need is love. There can be no such thing as a traditionless, non-structured learning how to love. And the church is a place where that can happen, even when we see sometimes the kind of anti-love baggage that has accompanied our church and our tradition. But the experience of violence also reveals something else that is very, very profound and very important for understanding the human learning how to love. In redoing the undoing of virtue that is caused by violence, so violence undoes virtue, and we're trying to redo it. The human learning to love is not a forgetting or erasure of violence. It is not even a moving beyond the experience of violence. It is always a moving in, through, and with that experience of violence. Especially since whatever shape love takes, whatever it looks like, will have something to do with the violence experienced. I want to be very careful here. I'm not saying that love needs violence to be realized. But the Christian hope that I'm pointing to affirms that violence does not make love impossible. But whatever love is, it can't cancel what has been done. The violence affirmed as part of our own story is eternally part of that story, even if our story is not reducible to that violence. And in thinking about this, I'm reminded of the icon of the Ascension. We see Christ ascending to the Father, and in some icons, especially in the Roman Catholic and especially the Russian tradition, you still see the marks of the crucifixion. You see, a resurrection always implies an ascension, a movement towards God the Father in Christ by the Spirit. But we don't leave our cross behind. We carry the marks of those crosses with us. But they don't have the final say. So the word that comes to mind here is forgiveness. But like love, I think we've become a little bit too familiar with this word, especially in seeing that it's something as something that can be willed or obligated. One does not will forgiveness. One becomes forgiveness. And this becoming forgiveness is a relationality where you don't forget, negate, or even move beyond the wrong done, but you exist in the midst of it and as a result of such a wrong. Forgiveness is an event that moves in, through, and with such contrary experiences, as it does not allow our individual stories and the story of creation to be reduced to such experiences. Love as forgiveness does not point to a border beyond those bad things that have happened, such as violence, but to a more than that is constituted by but not reducible to the experiences. Look, what I'm trying to get at is, if you have two people and there's forgiveness involved, so one person wronged the other, and if there's real forgiveness, where one really wants to be forgiven and one really forgives, then what is really remarkable, what is absolutely remarkable, is that those two people now can have a relationship of intimacy and love. But think about this now. It's because they have forgiven. Because there is forgiveness. In other words, that their relationship of intimacy and love, that bad thing that happened, isn't forgotten. It's still there. It's still part of their relationship. It hasn't gone away. That's the power of forgiveness. I often tell my students this. I say, even if there's no God, I believe very strongly that there's a God, but I tell them, even if there is no God, how remarkable is it that the universe somehow has woven into its fabric forgiveness? For me personally, one of the reasons why I do believe in God is not because the sun rises and the sun sets and all these other kinds, and seeing Katoomba the other day and things like that. It's because of forgiveness. How could the universe be random and there's forgiveness? Forgiveness isn't random. So, again, the point that I'm trying to make, which is a necessary caution to Christians and to rock stars who proclaim easily, you know, all you need is love, is that love is hard work. Love is learned in the face of radical otherness and negative experiences. But for myself, it's a learning driven by the hope that St. Paul articulates. It's one of the most powerful passages of the Bible, where he says that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Thank you. Any questions? I'm happy to take questions on other things as well, whatever you might have interest in terms of just Orthodox Christianity, or because that is my specialty.
Dr. Arasaro, just as people are about to ask questions, if I can ask one initially. You mentioned about the effect of violence on the person, on us, on people. I'm just wondering, can you say something about perhaps the difference, if it's possible, of violence as it affects the person of the perpetrator compared to the victim?
Ah, yeah, that's a good question. There's more and more evidence now that committing violence also has effects on the brain and on the human person as well. It's a very good question. There are statistics that show, this is really remarkable. They have statistics that show that During World War II, the American soldiers, when they went on the beaches of Normandy, and that their misfiring rate, so they misfire, was almost 80%. Very high. Now, you could attribute it to a lot of things, perhaps they did because of lack of training and some other things, but what they started to realize is that they were missing on purpose. They were missing on purpose. There's this remarkable story of this story I read of this son, and he went back to Italy with his father, and they had a kind of rough relationship growing up and so on and so forth, and they went back to Italy, and the father went on the battleground where he was, you know, fighting, I would imagine it would be the Italians or the Germans, I don't know, but anyway, he was in Italy and fought, and apparently he sort of as he was on this battleground, he kind of lost himself a little bit, and he started saying verbally, "We killed so many people, we killed so many people." And he started to cry. And then later in a coffee shop, his son asked him, he said, "What happened?" He said, "I've never said those words before in my life." He goes, I know that, you know, we were on the right side, and I know the Germans were wrong, but then you become kind of a killing machine, he said. And so there is a lot of evidence, actually, that's emerging more and more about the effects of killing on the human person as well, in terms of making this learning how to love difficult and the kinds of self-loathing it causes, and a lot of symptoms, it could lead to being symptomatic and so on and so forth. So even if you are on the right side, even self-defense, even, you know, killing another person is indicative that we're not created to do that. We're just simply not created to do that easily and without some kind of negative bodily kind of reaction. So it's a good question. There's a lot more evidence and statistics which you can probably find on the internet and some other. There's an excellent book by a guy named Grossman from the United States about this particular thing. So Grossman, yeah, Grossman. Yeah, I forget the name of the book. The name of the book is escaping me a little bit, but the name of the book is escaping me. But I'm terrible at remembering names. But it might come to me as it might come. If I get internet, I can look it up on Amazon. If you Google Grossman and killing, it should come up. So yeah. I think there was a question here, yeah.
Thank you for your talk. In your readings and studies of the social sciences about violence, have you ever come across or seen hints of the word confession or reconciliation as a means of healing the lingering effects of violence?
No, I haven't come across that particular kind of phrase. I've come across things like reconciliation commissions, right? And what they're trying to do is do a kind of national reconciliation that obviously has something to do with violence that occurred within a nation. There's a lot of controversy for those reconciliation commissions, whether they really affect true reconciliation or whether the perpetrators are just trying to get off or other kinds of things. It's probably a mix, right? I mean, there's a lot of discussion in my field about what's called political forgiveness. And it's clear that whatever political forgiveness means, it cannot mean an experience of forgiveness like me face to face with somebody else. It just can't mean that, right? I have this one story which I like to tell about forgiveness that's really very powerful. There was a shooting in the Bronx years ago, and two boys, after they heard about it, kind of went to the scene, and one of the boys started bragging that they went there and they knew who did it, when in fact the boy didn't know who did it. And then the police, these boys were like 12 years old, and the police then interrogated the boys and And the other boy, the one who didn't brag, after days and days of interrogation at his home, and he was so anxiety ridden and just wanted to get it over with, they opened this book with faces, and he just pointed to someone randomly. And so the police went and picked up and arrested this person in Brooklyn, actually, who had, it was almost impossible he had any connection to this crime. But for some strange reason, which is a little bit scary, a jury convicted him of the murder. And then someone committed to releasing innocent prisoners, got him out, after many years, though, after seven, eight, maybe years, finally did get him out. And then they had in Brooklyn, they had a celebration. He was out. They had a barbecue. And then the boy who pointed it, who basically put him in prison, showed up. I'm not sure exactly why. I'd have to go back and listen to the podcast. But he basically came. They were having a backyard. He came through. And the boy, now 20-year-old man, as soon as he saw the person that he basically fingered, broke down and cried. Can you imagine now living with that for 8 years? I mean, so this gets to your point of committing violence. This is a kind of violence when you finger an innocent person for prison. And the guy who was in jail said to him, he said, "Get up." He goes, "I had forgiven you a long time ago." Can you imagine that? Now they have a relationship together, and I can't even imagine that. Right? I mean, I can't even even think about that to some extent. So I think forgiveness face-to-face is a very powerful event. The church used to have public acts of confession, but that's always a bit tricky because forgiveness requires trust. And we have to be honest. I mean, one of the things we're working at within our own parish is trust amongst each other. So it's not necessarily the case that someone over there is not going to go use it against you in some way. And that's why our church has face-to-face confession, because the face-to-face is very powerful. It's much more powerful than doing it behind a screen. Because in the end, I think what we all long for is to face God and to feel forgiven. And I think the priest is the closest thing we have to that experience, actually. So political forgiveness is out there. I think it's worth a try. It's always going to be controversial, but it's never going to be the same as face-to-face forgiveness. But in the end, you confessional reconciliation. You need reconciliation. Always is confessional in the sense of telling the truth. But at the mass political level, I think it can have good effects, but it's never going to be quite the same thing as. Quite the same thing as, and people, it's interesting, I always think of the Greeks and the Turks, right? I mean, like, at some point, perhaps the relationship is going to be, who knows, it's going to be, we're just going to forget about all that happened. But real reconciliation is when you really, really put that, you don't allow that memory to incite anger. And, you've really forgiven someone when you look at them and you think about that event and it doesn't quite evoke that kind of anger. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult, and it takes a lot of self-reflection. It takes a lot of ascetical work. So.
And I guess also understanding.
Correct.
That is the most powerful thing to know. Oh, sorry. Yeah, understanding the human condition, that is a very good starting point. And I think between what you spoke this evening with psychology and the practice of our wonderful faith, that's where the truth lies.
I agree.
And we have to be eager searchers of that. So we shouldn't waste our time. We should make some time on a daily basis. We don't we don't want to reduce our sacraments and our practices to just ritualistic, meaningless processes, which can unfortunately happen given our state.
Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, that's in the end, God is always loving us no matter what we do, and that's because God understands. God understands the human condition, and the rituals and the liturgy that we do is not to score points with God, but it's ultimately to transform our bodies.
It's
and we don't do it because of this, but more and more evidence is showing scientifically that these kinds of ritualistic practices. And one of the questions I have is that in an age now where people are leaving religion, I think this happens in Australia, it's happening in America, it's happening in Western Europe, and they're declaring I'm spiritual but not religious, one of my questions is, what are your rituals? You know, where are your ritualistic practices? And who do you share them with? And, you know, I tell my kids all the time, I said, do you like Easter? I said, do you like, you know, they love it. I said, well, you can't have Easter by being spiritual and not religious. It doesn't work that way. Whatever you're experiencing as a result of Pascha is because of religion. That wouldn't have happened if everybody declared they were spiritual and not religious. So, you know, you can't throw away the baby with the bathwater. And I think that, I do think that there's evidence that shows that ritual, we just need to kind of build on that evidence and take it, have it take us to a new realm. Thank you very much. This was nice. Thank you so much for coming out.
Through the prayers of our Holy Fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well.